From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. During his time, Robert Ripley was one of the most famous people in the world, which in of itself is interesting considering this description by his biographer, Neil Thompson, a shy, goofy, portly, buck-toothed stutterer. But Ripley became a world traveler, too, a multimedia pioneer. He was incredibly rich and flamboyant and something of a ladies' man. Most of us know Ripley for the franchise he built around his strange and exotic discoveries, but he also fancied himself a mythbuster and a truth-teller. Today in the program, Neil Thompson is joining us to talk about Robert Ripley, not just his travels and collections, but also how he sought to remake the world's aesthetic. The strange and brilliant life of Robert Ripley, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Not all of you are going to remember Robert Ripley. He's been dead for decades. But most of you know of Ripley and his famous catchphrase, believe it or not. Robert Ripley was a cartoonist first, but that blossomed into a massive franchise built around his strange and exotic discoveries, the freaks and the oddities. You can still find his kitschy museums at places where tourists gather. Neil Thompson has written a biography of Ripley, and today in the program he's joining us to talk about his life. Thompson describes Ripley as an insecure and effete kid who became one of the most recognized celebrities in the country. It's hard to explain his appeal because it went beyond America's fascination with the weird. Thompson says people liked his goofy, everyman perception of the world. His limited education and his simplistic worldview seemed to match the sensibilities of his core audience. Today in the program, Neil Thompson is joining us to talk about the book. It's called A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert, Believe It or Not, Ripley. Neil Thompson is a veteran journalist and biographer. His latest book on Ripley is his fourth. He's also written about the astronaut Alan Shepard and the birth of NASCAR. Neil Thompson is based in Seattle, joining us today, though, from NPR in New York. And Neil Thompson, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Great to be here. Hi, Doug.
Well, I guess let's start with the story where you kind of stumble across this project that takes over your life for 5 years or something like this. It's 2007. You're reading the New York Times, and you read something about Robert Ripley, which leads you to sort of look into his life, and you discover at some point no one's really written a definitive biography of the guy. But what was the catch? What was the thing that drew your attention?
Well, I think it was a couple of paragraphs that described Ripley the man, and I experienced one of these aha moments that come along very rarely in a writer's life. Interestingly enough, I'm in NPR Studios in New York, about five blocks from the museum that triggered this whole project and obsession of mine. So reading the New York Times 2007, it was a story about a Ripley's Believe It or Not museum opening up on Times Square. And, you know, this is the New York Times. It didn't seem to be the right kind of story for them, but the writer sort of gushed about how entertaining and fascinating the place was. And then he goes on to describe Ripley the man for just a few paragraphs. And I had this realization that, of course, there was a Ripley. It's called Ripley's Believe It or Not. I sort of knew there was a Ripley the man. I had worked in newspapers for years, saw the cartoon in my newspapers growing up. I would read the Ripley's Believe It or Not books when I was a kid, but never really gave much thought to who this guy was. So after reading that New York Times article, I started digging around and discovered, number one, he was a fascinating character, and number two, nobody had ever written his full life story. At the time, I had been working on a different book project and literally that afternoon dropped it and dove headfirst into researching the life of Ripley.
Wow. What do you think? I mean, I think we'll get to this as we go along because we need to sort of establish his backstory before we get to the real I guess, truth of his appeal to people. But what was it essentially, do you think, that was so appealing about Robert Ripley? Because as I said in the introduction, and I think this is an important point you make in the book, it's not just that we liked the freaks he brought toward us, it was something about him and his kind of, as you say, everyman approach to the world.
Yeah, you definitely touched on it in that nice introduction, because I think I think it wasn't just the things he presented to readers in his cartoons or on his radio programs. I think is what he presented as himself. I think ultimately for me, this was an underdog story. Yeah. You know, we'll talk about his childhood a little bit, but he grew up poor, buck-toothed, shy, mocked as a kid, but became this, as you mentioned, this multimedia pioneer whose influence I think is still with us today. So that journey from this poor, shy kid to what he became at the height of his fame and popularity is just the perfect underdog story and kind of a reflection of the types of underdogs that he celebrated himself.
Yeah.
And so one reason I think he achieved that level of celebrity during his day was because people saw themselves in him. He wasn't the spit polished, TV ready celebrity. He remained a goofball, yeah, kind of his whole life. Yeah. You know, he wasn't pretty looking. He wasn't eloquent. He continued to stutter into adulthood because of these buck teeth. He couldn't speak very eloquently, and I think people responded to that and appreciated that he was one of them.
Robert Ripley grows up in Santa Rosa, California, and it's an interesting place to grow up. I mean, it had, you point out, timbermen and miners and vintners, and it was an area that you say attracted this mix of romantic eccentrics. And this seems to be one of the clues to the things that interested Robert Ripley himself, I guess. And he was surrounded by strange people, I guess.
Yeah, he was. And he talks about that later in his life, how he and he doesn't dwell either on the negative aspects of his childhood. Yeah. Later in life, he doesn't really talk about being poor, doesn't talk about being alone most of the time. But he does talk about the influence of Santa Rosa on his curiosity about the world and his appreciation for the strangeness of the world. So it was really a Wild West town when he was born, 1890, briefly past the Cowboys and Indians days. But it attracted this wild mix of vintners, you know, early wine country, ranchers, missionaries, and then people who wanted to get away from the, you know, East Coast and do their own thing. So there were, communes, early communes that, yeah, were set up around Santa Rosa. There was a little Chinatown where Ripley spent a lot of his time, which instilled this appreciation for the Chinese culture and, yeah, food and clothes. That mix of influences of his childhood, I think, really set him up for what he became and established that sort of base curiosity that he had and carried through the rest of his life.
His connection to China is really interesting. You write about times in his life when he's had difficulty. I mean, he gets fired from two jobs in 2 years, which he saw as a good thing ultimately. But when he was feeling bad about all of that, he would wander around Chinatown. What was the comfort he took from that culture and from that place?
You know, I think it was the sense of being different. So there was the Chinatown of his childhood in Santa Rosa, and then when he started his newspaper career, he was a sports cartoonist for two different newspapers in San Francisco. He spent a lot of time in San Francisco's Chinatown. Part of the reason was he could eat cheaply there. He wasn't paid very well when he first started out, about $8 a week. But I think because he's still into early adulthood, felt like a little bit of an oddball and a misfit, he felt, strangely comfortable among the Chinese. I guess because they were strangers in this land as well, and he just had this affinity for them, and it carried through the rest of his life. He was obsessed with traveling to China. He was obsessed with Chinese art and culture. Later in life, when he started attracting this harem of girlfriends, most of them were Chinese or at, yeah, least Asian. China became a part of the theme of his life.
It was in high school where people first started paying attention to his drawing. You say that he was constantly practicing, constantly drawing, and you describe them, or he did anyway, as the kind of the happiest, kind of purest school moments of his life, this idea of drawing.
Yeah, when he had just a sheet of paper in front of him and no other obligations, and he could just get lost in his drawings. He was really, I think he was probably fortunate to have found something that that he was passionate about at an early age. He was also an athlete and thought about becoming a baseball player, but really what he wanted most was to draw and to find a way to do that for a living, which was a pretty rare thing at that time. One of the things I love about his art and his drawing is that he was never trained.
Yeah.
He just did it himself. He would run around the house sketching his mother or his sister, asking them to sit and pose for him. He had a 5-cent postcard of a painting done by a Russian artist that he would copy and do it over and over and over again. Then when he started working – and so through high school, he worked at his school newspaper. He would do caricatures of teachers, which kind of got him noticed by his classmates. And then at a key moment toward the end of his high school years, he actually didn't finish high school, caught the attention of a woman who was visiting his family, actually staying with his family as a tenant. And she said, "Hey, you're pretty good. Have you ever thought about working for a newspaper?" And ultimately, she helps him get his first job in San Francisco.
You say that he had this stutter as well, awkward in front of people, those terrible teeth again, really disfigured in some ways. And yet art gave him a sense of confidence. And you say that it seems like there were these turning points throughout his life. You say that he could have retreated, really crawled into a hole, or could have created a more defiant persona. And he chose that latter part. And defiance seems to be an interesting kind of characteristic of Rupali.
Yeah, and I think it's something that carried through for the rest of his days. He easily could have been this awkward guy who just did some simple job that kept him away from people. At one point, his mother suggested he consider the seminary. Yeah. But he wanted more out of life, and he was willing to push himself to get the things that he wanted in life. We can touch on this later, but one thing I always found amazing was that this guy who, stuttered and couldn't speak well and was very had terrible stage fright, sort of willed himself to become eventually a lecturer and a radio star. So I think everything he did in his life was part of that just defiance. I'm going to do this no matter what, no matter what the hardships are, no matter what the setbacks are. I'm going to become the successful guy I want to become, whether it's becoming an artist despite having no art training, become a world traveler despite having never left his hometown up until he was a young man. He just sort of threw himself into everything he wanted to accomplish.
There's a section early on in the book where you write about Robert Rupali and his family lived through the 1906 earthquake. I mean, it tore Santa Rosa apart. There was more damage there, I think you say, than in San Francisco proper. Right. And it's interesting that he, as you say in the book, he rarely talked about the earthquake as an adult. Did he put aside elements of his childhood or the sort of more difficult parts of his life in some ways when he was older?
I think he did. I think he probably had this capacity to compartmentalize. For one, his father died a year after the earthquake, or less than a year. I describe in the book sort of those twin back-to-back hardships of his childhood. You know, having his hometown devastated by the earthquake, dozens of people were killed. Actually, scores of people in Santa Rosa proper, and then losing his father at a young age. Neither of those things did he talk about much as an adult, and I think part of that had to do with his ability to just forge on, not dwell on hardship, put a positive spin on things. I mean, I think he was a pretty happy guy and a very positive guy, and I think that worked well for him. He just had this sort of can-do attitude about everything and didn't dwell on the negative.
How difficult was it to do the research for all of this? I mean, you were granted this unfettered access to the room that contained the Rupali's, believe it or not, company archives. This is in Orlando, Florida. And so you had all of this archival stuff, but you also mentioned Rupali wasn't much for self-reflection. And it's interesting, you also write about that he was inclined to kind of fudge the truth about his life. I mean, he gave various dates about his birth. You talk about how he said he started his newspaper career when he was 16. Turns out he was actually 19. I mean, this couldn't have been easy to sort of run down all the truth of his life.
No, it was definitely tricky and challenging because I think over the years, certain accepted truths about his life have kind of crept into, public record or certain other stories about Ripley, including the Ripley Company that I worked with. They had certain understandings about who he was that by being the first person to really dig deep into his life, I was able to clarify some of these half-truths that Ripley himself perpetuated. But the research was great. And again, this goes back to that day of discovering the story and deciding to plunge into it realizing early on that it was going to be a challenge because Ripley, although he was briefly married as a young man, that ended after three years later in divorce. Yeah. He never had kids. None of his family members are alive, or at least no one who, had direct access to him. There are still two nephews who are living here outside of New York, but they were little kids when he was alive. So I knew I wasn't going to have too many people to interview, which is tricky for a journalist to not be able to talk to people who knew the person you're researching. So I knew those challenges would exist early on. Fortunately, after a couple of meetings with this Ripley company, I was able to convince them, as you say, to open up this climate-controlled archive that they keep in Orlando, and it was an absolute treasure trove. I mean, I did plenty of research in other places in other ways, but a lot of the the original source material that I needed, Ripley's personal letters, his travel journals, home movies, travel films, business documents, everything, almost everything I could have hoped for was there. But you're right, what was probably missing from all of his leftover stuff was that personal reflection, that little bit of him talking about what it all meant to him or why he did things. And that was tricky to get around that. I think I ultimately decided myself that even if it existed or if Ripley was around today, I don't think he would have reflected too much anyway.
Yeah.
I don't think that was how he was built.
Yeah.
Did what he did.
Yeah, I got the sense that he had kind of some – maybe some version of, attention deficit disorder almost. Like the guy was always on the move, not taking much time to, do much navel gazing, just sort of moving on to the next thing almost.
Absolutely. Yeah. He was moving all the time in on every level, literally moving. He would travel obsessively every chance he could. And in his business life, he just never stopped. He was always trying to find, new items for his newspaper cartoon. Later, as he becomes more successful, he was trying to find new outlets for his Believe It or Not brand, which we'll discuss, but branched off into lectures and radio shows, museums, best-selling books, eventually television. So he just never stopped. On top of that, he was always collecting things. He eventually bought this mansion outside of New York that we'll touch on that he filled with all those collections from around the world. He always had a project. So I think ADHD was definitely at play there.
Yeah.
Maybe also some hoarding tendencies as well.
I wonder if it was at all you were granted this incredible access to this archive. You talked to family members. As you say, he didn't have children, but he had nieces and nephews. But you also write about the sort of more complicated parts of his life. I mean, let's be honest, his comments about women, his tendency to have a temper from time to time, the way he wrote about certain races. He could be kind of boorish. He seemed like an obnoxious tourist sometimes. We'll get into that, I have to say, on one hand. But he's a complicated figure. Did you feel uneasy about presenting that side of Robert Ripley?
Not at all. I think that's both the challenge and for lack of a better word, the fun of writing a biography of a complicated person is to show all sides of that person.
Yeah.
I didn't want to show someone only in the most positive of light. I wanted to show all facets of him. We're all complicated people. We all have our faults, and Ripley had plenty. And I think it makes someone much more enjoyable to read about and to appreciate if you see them warts and all. Yeah. And Ripley had plenty of warts. I mean, he did have boorish views on other cultures. He had misogynistic views of the role of women at that time. And I tried not to shy away from that.
Neil Thompson is with us. His book is called A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert, Believe It or Not, Ripley. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're exploring the strange and brilliant life of Robert Ripley. The writer Neil Thompson has written a book about Ripley. He describes him as a connoisseur of mosts and bests, of fastest and farthest, of the weirdest and freakiest the world could offer. Ripley traveled the world looking for the strange and exotic, and Thompson says he could be sophisticated one moment and at another moment an insensitive doofus. But that was part of his appeal. Thompson's book is called A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert, Believe It or Not, Ripley. So Robert Ripley becomes this cartoonist, and he comes of age in the era of yellow journalism, finds a place in New York eventually, gets the confidence, you say, starts to really dress the part. Let me say something about that, first of all, because he has these kind of this uniform. I mean, he's really kind of a dapper guy, really liked to play the part.
Yeah, he did, which, going back to what we were discussing earlier about the poverty he came from, I think that was his effort to stand out and be noticed for something other than his buck teeth, to sort of dress the part of the New York journalist and make himself feel a little bit less like the doofus that he often felt like he was.
Right.
I think it's a reflection of that underdog quality he had. He was not willing to be the guy, the little kid from Santa Rosa who got mocked. He wanted to be part of the New York journalistic establishment and willed himself to become that.
Yeah. He loved those black and white wingtips, didn't he? I mean, every picture I see, he's got them on.
The photos of him are great. There's some on my website and in the book. And there's this interesting app you can download for the book and see more shots of him. But most of his outfits are fantastic. Wingtip shoes with shorts, knee-high white socks, a safari helmet in some of the photos. He could be dapper too. You know, he could dress up in a tux or a suit, but he always had those two-tone wingtip shoes, sometimes covered with spats. That was part of his outfit too. Interestingly, I came across a little tidbit that he was the model for Elmer Fudd.
Wow. Is that right?
Yeah.
You know, that's really interesting. So people were kind of mocking him, even in popular culture, right?
A little bit, yeah. The early version of Elmer Fudd was this guy named Egghead who was Bucktooth, and he stuttered.
Yeah.
And he would, in some of the early episodes, before he was renamed Elmer Fudd, did travelogue mm-hmm. presentations from South Seas Islands, for example. So that's where Elmer Fudd came from, was from Ripley.
Ripley has this breakthrough moment in 1918. You talk about how they're, I guess, different versions of the story, but one of them says it was this winter afternoon. It's December of the year. The war is over. The football season is over. Baseball season hasn't started yet. And, of course, he's a sports cartoonist, so he's looking for some ideas. And I guess it's at this point he comes upon the concept of Believe It or Not.
Yeah, I think it's something that had been percolating for a while. So as a sports cartoonist, his job was to go to the ball game or the boxing match and draw a couple sketches from that event, some of which were serious sketches, actual artwork that appeared in the newspaper to accompany the reporter's story. Or sometimes it was a standalone cartoon in which Ripley described the events of that sporting event. So that was his job. He was a reporter who drew pictures of what he covered. But he also had the leeway or developed the trust of his editors to be able to create to experiment a little bit,
right,
to create cartoons that went in different directions. And so Occasionally, during the teens, he would experiment with this idea of extreme sports feats.
Right.
Again, keeping within the parameters of his job as a sports cartoonist, but at the same time, exploring his own curiosity about extremes. He describes it later in life in different ways, but the gist of it is that day in December, he had over time compiled some samples of these extreme sports feats and decided to put them all into one cartoon.
Yeah.
So I think there were nine of them, nine mini feats. He titled it Champs and Chumps.
Yeah.
It wasn't Believe It or Not yet. And it was people doing interesting things. The guy who walked across the America backwards, the person who stayed underwater for 6 minutes, the two people who won the fastest three-legged race. Just silly, fun sports accomplishments. There's some mythology about how it happened. You know, later in life, he would say, you know, that led to another one, and then another one, and before, you know, within a year or so, it was up and rolling and was a big hit. It was much more of a drawn out process than that.
Yeah.
The next Believe It or Not themed cartoon came months later,
right,
and only appeared sporadically into the 1920s before he really focused on it and decided this is where I need to focus my energies on this Believe It or Not concept. But it did start with that afternoon in December of 1918.
And you say in the book that so his marriage kind of goes south. His personal life got a little bit messier there in those early days. And you say as that was going on, his cartoons seemed to grow incrementally stranger, weirder. Talk about how his cartoons are evolving. And they got more bizarre, I guess. Is that right?
They did. And I think there are a couple things at work there. One is some of the things he explored during World War I. He was able to travel during that time within the U.S., but went to different military bases and played sort of this role in describing what was happening during the war in cartoon form. So I think that initially contributed to his ongoing curiosity about other places around the world. Then his marriage to this Ziegfeld Follies dancer, Beatrice, ends in divorce. At the same time, you've got Prohibition coming into play. Ripley was a big drinker,
yeah.
and that increased through Prohibition. Then there's this turning point moment in 1921 where he kind of escapes from it all, escapes
right.
from Prohibition, escapes from his dying marriage, and does this kind of spectacular around-the-world trip financed by the Globe. And that is the moment that I argue in the book really changes everything, because suddenly he's able to finally see firsthand some of the places he's only read about or dreamed about.
Yeah.
And that changes the entire tone of his cartoon and takes him in this, as you say, a new direction, more weird and worldly.
Yeah. The paper called it Ripley's Rambles Around the World. And you say
right.
it's here on this trip where he really finds his voice. I mean, he starts to weave into it's not just the cartoons now, it's him writing about history and writing about culture and these weird facts and this personal opinion. And in some ways, it's like he's the first blogger, I think is how mm-hmm. you put it in the book.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's fascinating because if you read the tone of these essays that he wrote for this Ramble Around the World, it is like somebody's blogging. It's somebody talking directly to you, the reader. Hey, here I was in Buenos Aires, and boy, it's really hot, and my suit got soaked, and I felt like a doofus standing on the piazza as people were looking at me. You know, really personal stuff. So it wasn't just, you know, the type of travelogue where he's describing, you know, cattle ranching in Argentina in a dry sort of journalistic way. He's talking about himself and what
yeah.
he's seeing and doing. He talks openly, blatantly, sort of tauntingly about his drinking escapades, mm-hmm. and the women he attempts to chase after. I think he starts to develop this voice, and it becomes the kind of voice that he'll use throughout the rest of his career, and it's the one that people respond to the most, the dorky American traveler,
yeah,
basically.
He's kind of in some way. There's the story you tell. This happens later, but he's in the Syrian desert. And it's interesting. He's accompanied by this young Mormon guy from Utah, Joe Simpson.
Right.
And as I said, you get the sense that he was one of those kind of obnoxious tourists. Both of these guys were. They were taking pictures of everything, pissing off from time to time, you know, the locals. He was kind of a bore. And then he could be sophisticated. So there's this sort of duality going on with Robert Ripley or something.
Yeah, absolutely. And friends would comment on it later on, but couldn't ever quite figure out what it all meant, because he had this huge appreciation for other people and other places. He loved to see how other people lived, you know, cultures where they practiced certain religions. He had admiration for that. But then he would get, you know, ticked off if he couldn't find a good drink in a strange place. He shared all this openly in his essays. He wasn't shy about trying to be too politically correct. He would admit to, you know, drinking too much or feeling uncomfortable in a place where he was one of the only white faces.
Right.
And at times he would cross the line and use language that we would cringe at now.
Right.
But I think ultimately the whole package was he was willing to put himself out there. Physically out there and go to these places and mingle with people. He was also willing to sort of describe getting off the beaten path and you know, exploring villages and getting to know the locals, even if he was a little bit nervous and insensitive. He would do it. He would put himself in that position.
Yeah, I can't tell if he was just a man of his era in terms of the way he talked about race, because there are a couple of things like Canton, he describes as this vast rabbit warren of slant-eyed humanity. And then he says there's another part, I think it's in your book, where he writes about Nairobi being full of stupid white people trying to change the age-old habits of the Africans. You know what I mean? I mean, he's complicated. He's not just a racist. He also didn't think much of the stupid white folks, too.
I totally agree. Yeah, and that duality is sort of on display throughout his life, and it's confusing and it's complicated, because he wasn't just a bore and he wasn't just a racist. He I think he did use the language of the time.
Yeah,
that's part of it. But I think he had this sort of strange objectivity about his views on how the world should be, and if he felt like Westerners were having an effect on a certain country, they should butt out and let people be who they are.
Yeah,
he's a complicated guy, no doubt about it.
Let's talk about this holy city in India of Benares. I think it's Varanasi today is what they call it. He arrives there in this world trip in 1921, I guess, and he says of all the places he had traveled, this was the most fascinating and the most, I think he says, baffling. And in the book, you say this is really the kind of the epicenter for those extremes of Hindu spirituality. But it's interesting the way you describe his reaction to that place. Fascinated and revolted, you say, on one hand, but also really, really moved. What was it that was moving, do you think, about that place for Robert Ripley?
I think there was a lot that was kind of overwhelming to him about Benares. I think some of it has to do with his appreciation for other religions. And here's a place where he saw people, you know, laying on a bed of nails or staring into the sun until they went blind or holding their arms aloft until their arms stayed fused above their heads, all in devotion to their gods. And I think he was astounded by that, and again appreciated it. One thing that I see throughout his career, as he features either the religious aesthetics in a place like Benares, or someone with a disability, or someone with some strange ability, is he wasn't cynical about it.
Yeah.
He had this gee whiz attitude. Isn't that weird and fascinating that the people in Benares, India, do this?
Right.
Similarly, on that trip we're discussing, he saw the burning ghats, the funeral pyres, where people would burn on a pile of wood their deceased loved ones, and then throw the ashes into the Ganges River. Mm-hmm. He was just, you know, he couldn't keep himself away from this kind of thing. He was just fascinated and astounded by it. And he goes on and on in his essays from that ramble around the world, describing Benares. I think I describe in the book how he sent 8 dispatches back to New York from Benares alone, and then only a couple from Rome and Paris, which I think were places that seemed a little boring to him after a place like India. But again, it wasn't cynical. It wasn't mocking. It was a holy cow, look at this kind of attitude. And I think that's what his readers and fans responded to.
You say that going around the world kind of rewired him. He's haunted by the experience. He's completely transformed by the experience. And it's interesting, he says, after, you know, seeing starvation and poverty and ignorance, he says he wasn't ready to reform the world. I can't reform myself. And there's this thing he writes in the journal that you record. He says, why should the spirit of mortal be proud ideals? Be proud. Ideals and actualities are far apart. What's he getting at there?
I think it's one of the few times I came across that self-reflection that's kind of elusive throughout his life and through my research. I think he came back a little shocked by how other people lived, a little bit saddened by it. I love the line about not being able to reform myself. I think he felt helpless. You know, what am I supposed to do? A lot of what he saw in China and India was poverty and hunger. He saw people begging on the streets, and he blatantly says it disgusted him at times. But I think he also had some sense of compassion for these people who were going hungry and begging for food. So I think it rattled him to see how hard off other people were. I think he maybe had a general sense of that before he went on this around the world trip, but to see it up close and to see the filth and poverty, I think it really shook him up. But I think he also admits pretty quickly, I don't know what to do about it.
Right.
I can't even fix myself. How am I going to fix these other parts of the world? But again, you touched on it. I think after that trip, it did alter the trajectory of his cartoon and the focus of all of his journalistic efforts that came afterwards. From that point forward, he was no longer a sports cartoonist. He became the Ripley's Believe It or Not guy who became curious about everything, in particular other parts of the world.
Neil Thompson is with us. His book is called A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert, Believe It or Not, Ripley. And we need to take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the journalist Neil Thompson. We're talking about his biography of Robert Ripley. It's called A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert, Believe It or Not, Ripley. So I want to ask how you were talking before the break there about how he comes back and his life has changed, is reoriented, the way he sees the world and the things that he presents to the rest of the world. And he became more and more interested in what he came to call queriosities. I mean, for the first time, he gave Sideshow Freaks really a place in a daily newspaper. What did he think about that idea of it didn't seem like he liked the word freaks. I mean, what did he think about that concept that these were where he was showing these freaks?
Yeah, I think he talks about not liking that word and preferring human oddities or human queriosities. That experience in India and seeing people do these sort of self-mutilating things to prove their devotion, that triggered this fascination with what people are willing to do to their bodies for whatever their reasons. And so he, after that trip in his cartoon and in his essays and soon thereafter in his first book, which became a bestseller, he explores that idea of what people do. some of it goes back to the sports extremes that he featured when he was just a sports cartoonist, people doing things to an extreme on the playing field or you know, some cross-country journey, some effort to push themselves and their bodies to an extreme. But then he twisted that curiosity about the extremes into what people do in sort of gruesome ways to their bodies.
Yeah.
People who will stick spikes in their nose or stick pins throughout their bodies or walk through coals. Then take that to the next level, and he becomes kind of intrigued with people with deformities.
Yeah.
The sideshow type people. There was a little girl named Frida Pushkin he featured in his 1933, a museum he called his auditorium, which appeared at the Chicago World's Fair. Mm. It was the first time he brought some of his curiosities to the stage. And she, cute little kid who happened to be missing both arms and both legs, but she could write with a pencil that she stuck under her chin and the nub of her arm. And I think Ripley actually appreciated these. And again, as we were talking earlier, he didn't mock them. There wasn't a cynicism about it. Mm. He thought, isn't it cool that she is missing her limbs but is able to function? And so he sort of championed the sideshow freaks and gave them, you know, a space in his cartoon, a space on his stage and on his radio show. He championed their efforts.
One of the things that I almost loved the most about him was his inclination to be kind of a skeptic, kind of a myth buster. I mean, you tell this story of a Ripley cartoon where he breaks, as you put it, the shocking news to most Americans that, in fact, Charles Lindbergh was not the first man to make a nonstop flight over the Atlantic Ocean. And he got this violent reaction from people. But talk about this part of his personality, to be what he called the noble truth teller.
Right. Yeah, there's so many aspects to the believe it or not brand of his day.
Yeah.
You know, we've been talking a lot about his world travels and how he focused on the strange people and places he visited with. But then there was this other aspect where he loved to tweak people. He loved to challenge them to think differently about certain things, commonly accepted truths, and shine a light in a way that altered that truth. So in the case of Lindbergh, soon after Lindbergh's transatlantic flight, he had this cartoon that said Lindbergh was the 67th man to cross the Atlantic. At the time, there was all this sort of national fervor about the accomplishment, and Ripley was just barraged with people calling him names and liar and how dare you. And he sort of calmly a few days later explained, well, two dirigibles had crossed the Atlantic carrying 30-plus people, and then in 1919 there were two aviators, Alcock and Brown, who crossed from Newfoundland to Ireland. So by eliminating the word solo, he was able to say that Lindbergh was the 67th man to cross the Atlantic, when in fact he was the first to do it solo. So I think he loved that. He loved to challenge people to think differently and then to prove that his statements were true. Another one that he got a lot of hate mail for was saying that St. Patrick, patron saint of Ireland, was not a saint. His name wasn't Patrick, and he wasn't Irish. And then, as he always would, a few days later, he would prove that his statements were true.
He had this really popular radio program, which was so innovative, it seems, for the time. I mean, he liked to take the show on the road. He went to Carlsbad Cavern and went to the Grand Canyon and did some broadcast from the bottom of a shark tank. And I guess it was pretty popular, the radio show.
It was. And this goes back to something we touched on earlier about him being constantly on the move and constantly trying new things and exploring new ideas. And with his radio show, he was never content to just be in a studio like you and I are now. He wanted to take his show on the road and push his show to the extreme, same kind of extremes that he was featuring on his show. So one show, he strapped a microphone to a skydiver and tried to have that skydiver describe his descent over the air.
Right.
Didn't quite work out because the guy's chute didn't, his main chute failed, and he had to rely on his backup chute and slammed into the earth and had the wind knocked out of him. You mentioned the Shark Tank.
Yeah.
Ripley put on a huge diver's suit and went underwater and described to listeners what it was like to feed sharks underwater. That one also almost ended badly when some blood that he had gotten onto his suit from a dolphin earlier in the show attracted the sharks that were circling him, and one of them bumped him on his butt, and he had to get helped out of the shark tank. I mean, so you know, he was always putting himself in these positions of at times actual danger, all in an effort to put on a good show.
Yeah. I want to play a clip from – he also had these really popular Warner Brothers shorts that I guess they played them before movies. Is that where we would have seen them in those days?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. These brief films that would appear, you know, in the theaters just before the main feature.
Let me play one. This is – this gives you a sense of I guess by today's standard, it's pretty patronizing, especially this one where he's describing this poor Muslim woman and showing her – unveiling her veil like she's this, you know, circus act or something like that. But it gives you a sense of – it's nice to hear the cadence of his voice and how he describes it and what people would have heard if they, you know, were going to a movie and would have seen one of these Ripley's Believe It or Not shorts. Here it is.
All women wearing veils look beautiful. Sometimes the thicker the veil, the greater the beauty. But they do not wear the veil because they are beautiful. The Prophet Muhammad thought women unworthy of the glances of men and ordered them to veil their faces to save the men the necessity of looking at them. Now let's see if Muhammad was right. Here is what a Mohammedan woman looks like without her veil. This lady is in her own home, the only place where she is permitted to remove her veil. She never shows her face except to her own husband. Yet if a woman wants to flirt, not even a veiled face will stop her. In the Sudan, they use this method.
And so it goes. Neil Thompson, you know, by today's standard, is pretty offensive. But this was – people were really – in some ways, this was the first time they were seeing some of these places and some of these cultures. That's interesting on one hand. The other part is he doesn't have the greatest voice in the world. He's not that charismatic. But people loved the guy.
Yeah. Yeah, I find that remarkable too. Even to this day, I love hearing him because you do realize he doesn't have a Bing Crosby like voice. Bing was a contemporary and actually another radio star of Ripley's day. You know, he sounds a little awkward. He's not a perfect radio speaker. But what I love is that, and we haven't exactly touched on this. Some of the films and the radio shows at the peak of his fame and popularity, they came during the 1930s, which is during the Depression.
Yeah.
And so he's bringing these stories like that one we just heard to America at a time when people can't travel, aren't learning about other places around the world necessarily because they're sort of hunkered down with their own challenges. So Ripley can bring them this entertainment from around the world on the cheap in their daily newspaper, or if they can afford a radio, they can hear him on the radio.
Yeah.
So I think his brand of entertainment, the reason it became so popular during the 1930s is because it's exactly what the country needed, this fascinating escape from everything else that was going on.
What was the deal with him wanting to take his clothes off all the time? Was he a nudist in some way?
I don't know. Could have been. I think he appreciated, walking around in the buff. I have some interesting home movies of him strutting around his island mansion north of New York in just a bathrobe. And in one of his travels, I describe in search of the Garden of Eden, he strips down naked and has his Mormon accomplice, Joe Simpson, take photos of him hiding behind the stump of a tree. You know, he's just a goofy guy who liked to have fun, and I guess that was one example of it.
May 24th, I think it's 1949, there's no footage of this television show. He has this pretty popular television show on NBC. The audiences really liked it. NBC liked it. But something happens during a live broadcast. He has kind of what they think might have been a small stroke, or he may have been a reflection of his bad heart, which he has, but he kind of, well, describe that story, if you will, because you tell it in the book.
Yeah, yeah. So this would have been his 13th TV episode, yeah. Interestingly. Even though he had been in pretty ill health, not on a sick bed, but he'd been drinking too much. He was now fairly heavy. He had episodes of anger. This is all after World War II, also after a trip that he had taken to China and seen the devastation that happened as a result of World War II in China and some of these places he loved. So after World War II, he was in a bad place. He was struggling physically and emotionally, with none of which prevented him from diving into another massive project, which was this TV show that started in early 1949. So we get to the 13th episode, which is a show in part features the funeral song Taps. Mm-hmm. And Ripley, during the show, his eyes glaze over and he kind of slumps over and his sidekick has to prop him up and keep the show going. He kind of snaps out of it and finishes the show. But a few days later, when he's in the hospital getting tests done on his heart, he suffers from a heart attack and dies at the age of 59.
Let me ask you this finally. Robert Ripley once said he believed that the Believe It or Not franchise would continue for many years after he died. And boy, has it. Where do you think that Ripley would fit in today's American culture? You know, because you sort of talk about him as the godfather of reality television, and he would have fit pretty well here.
I think he would have. I think the trick would be that he still would have been a goofy looking guy in an era where we appreciate you know, the Hollywood face. But I think he would have found his way. I could see him being a TV pioneer, a reality TV show mogul of some sort. And I do think you see reflections of the type of character Ripley was in guys like Anthony Bourdain and some of the reality TV shows. I think his influence is still with us. He taught us to believe in the unbelievable.
Neil Thompson. His book is called A Curious Man, The Strange and Brilliant Life of Robert, Believe It or Not, Ripley. Joined us from the NPR studios in New York. Neil Thompson, thanks very much.
Thank you, Doug. Really enjoyed it.
Radio West, production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.